Good evening and welcome to the November presentation, our fifth series of Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. Our speaker's appearance here tonight is made possible with additional support from the Kentucky Humanities Council, for which we're grateful. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I moderate this series with my colleague, Peggy Wright, who's out taking an exam tonight, with assistance from Haiwan Wan, who's our website coordinator. Our technical assistant tonight is our library technology coordinator, David Runner. A native Kentuckian, our speaker received his PhD in history from the University of Kentucky. He served as managing editor of the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society, as the executive director of the Kentucky Historical Society, and is presently a professor of history at Georgetown College and the state historian of Kentucky. A quick scan of the state's leading newspapers hints at what a demanding schedule he maintains. In the spring, he and his wife Frida were out promoting their new book, Faces of Kentucky, which is a delightful work for children with many biographies of interesting people, both famous and obscure. In June, he was part of the Civil War reenactors in Georgetown, commemorating Confederate General John Hunt Morgan's 1862 ride through Georgetown, Kentucky. On August 2nd, he hosted a seminar entitled, Is Kentucky Southern? At the Clark County Public Library. On August 30th, he delivered the first lecture on the life and times of Bert T. Coombs, former governor of Kentucky, at the Clay County Justice Center. In October, he sketched a vivid portrait of the 60 years when Lexington, Kentucky's stature was at its highest at a two-day Athens of the West conference at UK's Singletary Center. With an encyclopedic knowledge of the state's history, he does not shy away from historical controversy, and in recent years has been asked to comment on everything from a new book about President Lincoln's sexual persuasions, the present location of the bones of Daniel Boone's brother, Ned Jones, and the Triplett Thompson duel of 1829. He's the author, editor of 17 books, two of which have been recently released in paperback, Kentucky Justice, Southern Honor and the American Manhood, a really intriguing title from LSU Press, and Kentucky Portrait and Paradox, 1900 to 1950, recently reprinted by the Kentucky Historical Society. He's currently researching a book on Henry Clay and the American presidency, and he and his wife reside in Lexington, Kentucky. It's our pleasure to welcome the state historian of Kentucky, James Clotter, to talk about political scandals in Kentucky. Welcome, James.
Thanks very much. Can everybody hear me okay? I'm always glad to come back to Bowling Green. My parents both went to school here, and that's how they met. So without Bowling Green and Western, I wouldn't be here. So I'm always glad to come back. Plus, my son lives here, and we have two grandchildren here, so that's always fun to come back as well. And I thank Western and Barnes & Noble for hosting the series. I was thinking on the way here on the topic, Kentucky political scandals. I was thinking of a story that they used to tell about this man who was a Nobel Prize winner, a physicist. He was going around giving these quick speeches, going from town to town almost, and giving a quick 30-minute speech. Then, getting in, he had a chauffeur who had been driving to the next town, and he would give a talk there. He was raking in the money from that, of course. And the chauffeur one of these times said, I really admire you. He said, you get up there and you give this talk. And he said, people really like what you do and they applaud. And he said, it must really make you feel good about doing all that. And he said, yeah, but he said, it gets tired after doing it for a while. And the man said, well, I can't imagine that. He said, I would just love to do that. The Nobel Prize winner, being a smart man, he suddenly thought, he said, I'll tell you what. He said, we're about the same size. When we get to the next town, I've already got this talk already written out, he said, we'll switch. And I'll wear the chauffeur's uniform, and you get up there and just read the talk, and you'll get to do what you want, and I get to take a break from all of this. So the chauffeur got up there, and he started reading the talk, but he was nervous, and so he read it faster than he would normally read it. And he got through, instead of a high five, he got through in about 25 minutes. So the man who was up there as the host said, well, I see we have time for questions now. And you can see the perspiration starts forming on his forehead. And the first question is, well, could you tell me the difference between nuclear fusion and nuclear fission? and the real life chauffeur is, you know, starting to sweat heavily by this time, and suddenly you can see a smile comes on his face. He said, the difference between nuclear fission and nuclear fusion, the answer to that is so easy, even my chauffeur in the back of the room can tell you that. And called on him. So, yeah, that's the way I kind of feel when I'm talking about political scandals, that most of you here in the audience could probably talk about some of these scandals as well as I could. And I may just, you know, call on somebody back there and say, you know, talk about this as well as the chauffeur could in that particular instance. But really, I'm sorry to tell you that I searched Kentucky history, and I just could not find any political scandals out there. So I guess we should just all go home. Actually, I have a list of about, 10 other ones I didn't talk about today. So, but actually, as you know, and particularly we should know just, you know, after 2 days after an election, that one of the most important duties that we have in a democracy is to vote. You know, selecting those leaders is the linchpin of a successful democracy. Some people don't take that task very seriously, and they may not study the candidates, the programs at all, just vote willy-nilly. Certain people may trade their votes for promises of jobs or something else. Some people don't vote at all. You know, in this recent election, I know in Lexington where I voted, they talked about what a heavy turnout we had there. But I think across Kentucky, fewer than half of the people in the state who are eligible to vote cast a ballot in that election. So, you know, even a heavy turnout isn't really a heavy turnout. In 1920, Kentucky, for instance, ranked number one in the nation in the percentage of people who voted. And that was the first year that women could vote in Kentucky. And they had 80% of the electorate voted that year versus under 50% now. On the other hand, candidates for public trust must not abuse the power that voters give them as a people. You know, now what exactly though constitutes an abuse of power? You know, some people would argue that using a post for political, personal, financial gain certainly would qualify. But what about these scandals of a sexual nature? You know, are they in the same category? Should they be a concern? You know, the answer to that question, probably you can best answer it with this story. There was a well-known ballad singer who used to go around Kentucky. One of his favorite songs he would sing was a song called Napoleon Crossing the Rockies. Well, some person pointed out to him that Napoleon was never in America, much less crossing the Rockies. And the singer, you know, when confronted with that fact, he thought for a short time, and then he said, well, you know, historians differ. Historians do differ. Yeah, so, you know, that remains true, you know, how we as historians view scandals. We have different ways of looking at things. I give another talk sometimes called Leadership and Courage in Kentucky History. So today, you know, what we're going to talk about is the flip side of that, not leadership and not courage, in a sense. And we can see maybe if there's some lessons we can still learn. So let's begin, and I'll look at five different people quickly for about a half hour or so. And let's begin with James Wilkinson. Have you ever heard of James Wilkinson? A couple, three, so. He was a man that on the surface of much promise, of much achievement. You know, when the Revolutionary War started, he joined the cause. By the age of 20, he was a general fighting with George Washington. After the war ended, he moves to Kentucky. He becomes one of the most prominent political figures in the area. And in 1796, he becomes commander-in-chief of the entire United States Army. So he reaches the pinnacle in militarily. And after that, the President of the United States appoints him as a governor of Louisiana Territory. So he holds that particular post. Quite a career. Quite a person, it seems. There's only one thing wrong with that picture. James Wilkinson was a traitor. Not only that, but one of his biographers called him a finished scoundrel. Another study of his life is entitled The Tarnished Warrior. In fact, very few people who knew Wilkinson intimately said very much good about him. Politician John Randolph, who was a man who could really cut you to threads with his tongue if you were his political enemy, he had one of the great quotes, for instance, about Henry Clay. He said, Henry Clay was like a rotten mackerel in the moonlight. He both shines and stinks. Great imagery there. You know, he's like Henry Clay is like a rotten mackerel in the moonlight. He both shines and stinks. Well, Randolph simply wrote about James Wilkinson. He said, he is the only man I ever knew who was from bark to core a villain. So harsh words there. Teddy Roosevelt, who wrote about this time period, in one of his books, argued that, he said, Wilkinson had not the slightest idea of the meaning of honor. He betrayed his trust from the basest of motives. Modern-day historian Lowell Harrison from Western, he said that James Wilkinson could no more resist intrigues and conspiracies than he could practice frugality. So, you know, that's the man. So what has he done to deserve all this censure? Well, quite a bit, as it turns out. The surprise is not that he was criticized. The surprise is that he was able to survive and, in fact, garner all these offices in his career. Because behind everything he did lurked a desire for power and a desire for money. And his major scandal concerning Kentucky started when he came to the region at the age of 27 after the Revolutionary War. At that time, Kentucky wants to separate from the mother state of Virginia. The question is, what is going to happen? Are they going to join the Union, which was a very fragile union at that time? It had just changed one government, gone from the Articles of Confederation to the new Constitution. Would it change again in a few more years? Nobody knew. You know, would they join that government? Or would they separate and become a separate nation, like Texas does later, an independent country, the rest of the mountains, instead of a new empire? Or would Kentucky just leave the Union and ally with Great Britain to the north and with Spain to the south? You know, it was in this uncertain situation that Wilkinson comes to the forefront. You know, he's pompous, he's demanding, he's devious, he's selfish, he's verbose, and those are his good points. He now saw opportunity in all this discord that's out there. Kentuckians wanted to ship their goods. It was hard to ship them across the mountains, so they wanted to ship them down the Mississippi River to New Orleans, and then from there to other ports and other places where they could sell their goods cheaply. But Spain had closed the river to shipping. Wilkinson basically saw that he could capitalize on all this. And so he goes to the Spanish in New Orleans, and he convinces them that if they open the lucrative river trade to him only, that his popularity would help him gain support in Kentucky, and he would persuade Kentucky to declare its independence or else to join Spain. He wrote to the Spanish, "I will be able to alienate the Western Americas from the United States and throw them into the arms of Spain." He signs an oath of allegiance to Spain, and he gets $2,000 a year, which is a lot of money at that time, for the rest of his life from Spain. He's an agent of Spain. Remember what I said about his career after this, too. He uses those funds to try to bribe some Kentucky legislators, last time that would ever happen. Mostly, though, he just wrote and he argued for separation. In fact, one of his speeches went about 3.5 hours. Mine will be a slightly shorter than that. But he found that the English ties and the English tradition of most Kentuckians were too strong to break. And so Kentucky did enter the Union as the 15th state. But still, he continued to funnel information to Spain even after that time. He sent him the pay of Spain, even while he's commander-in-chief of the United States Army, while he's governor of Louisiana Territory later on. He dies in Mexico in 1825, still scheming, still searching for some new path to glory. And so that ends the Wilkinson story. Now, if he was maybe the basest scandal in Kentucky's history, our next person may have been the worst governor in the state's history. Though admittedly, that's a crowded field with many people vying for that honor. And by the way, if there's any relatives of Joseph Duché in the audience, you may want to leave and come back later. Joseph Duché. He had been a general and a congressman, and then he was elected governor in 1824. He immediately became controversial. He was a man from Mason counties and from Harrison counties. He supported a law, almost as soon as he became governor, to abolish the state, what is now the state Supreme Court. What had happened is that they had issued an unfavorable ruling on a law that had been passed. He couldn't overcome that, so his solution was, if we can't overcome the ruling, we'll get rid of the court. And so he appointed a new court of his supporters and abolished the old court, which, of course, refused to recognize the legality of that. So you had two courts vying for recognition in Kentucky. And it split the state. You know, it fostered the party spirit in the state. Both the Whigs and Democrats after that came from there. It almost created a political civil war in Kentucky. That was one of his areas. Another area was education. You know, Duché got involved in university politics. The last time a governor would ever do that, or not. Boucher forced the resignation of a very popular and very progressive president of Transylvania University. At that time, Transylvania University was one of the three best universities in the United States. It had a medical school and a law school. It had state support. When Jefferson Davis went to Congress, 10% of the people in Congress were graduates of Transylvania University. Now, that's how important it was as a regional school. But he got the president to resign, and after the president resigned, the university never got back to that level that it had been. And one of the state's best opportunities for educational greatness had passed from the scene because of those actions. But all of that paled in comparison to Duchesne's action in a matter that involved his own family. One of his 13 children was a young man named Isaac Bledsoe Duchesne. And in November of 1824, this young man was spending a night in a Fleming County tavern. The next morning, he met a newspaper man who was on his way to get married in New Jersey. When that man, a man named Francis Baker, was getting ready to leave the next morning, he said, "I have a friend's house I'd like to get to. Can somebody guide me to that house?" And Isaac Bledsoe Duchesne volunteered to do so. 6 days after that, some passerbys found a saddlebag, and then they found a partially clothed body of Francis Baker hidden under a log. His throat had been cut. Suspicion soon went to Duchesne, the son, who had been seen with similar-looking saddlebags, had been seen with a horse that looked like Baker's, and 5 days before Christmas, a jury indicted him for murder. And from that moment on, politics intruded in the whole process. Friends of the governor introduced a bill in the legislature to move the trial to Harrison County, the governor's home county. Without hesitation, the governor signed it into law when it did pass. That change of venue through legislative action was against all precedent. The trial began in January of 1825. Duchesne had gotten for his son some of the best legal counsel. He got John Round, the man who Federal Hill, Raleigh, Kentucky home. He'd also got the chief justice of this new court, that is the man he had appointed to that position to defend his son, the Supreme Court justice defending his son. But the jury still found the son guilty of murder. The presiding judge, who was also a friend of the governor's in this trial, he ruled that the jury had been subjected to undue pressure from outside, and he declared it a mistrial. So then he had to have another trial. And in his second trial, the jury again found Isaac Bledsoe Duchesne guilty of murder and sentenced him to hang. Just days before the date of his supposed execution, he tried to commit suicide by cutting his own throat. Told of his son's impending death, Governor Duchesne pardoned him so that the young man would die a free man, at least. But the air of freedom apparently improved the health of young Duchesne, and he lived. While he had to breathe through a silver tube that was inserted in his throat, breathe still he did. Well, a furor arose over that pardon, as you can imagine, which further damaged the governor's political standing. Of course, as we all know, that affair marked the last time executive pardons would ever be a factor in Kentucky politics, or not. In this case, the son moved to Texas under an assumed name, and then history seemed to repeat itself, because Duchesne was seen traveling with another man in Texas. The man disappeared, a body was later found, the throat was cut. Former Kentuckian in Texas recognized young Duchesne, the silver tube in his throat, and authorities began to question him. Supposedly, he admitted that he had killed him, but said it was self-defense. The jury didn't buy that, and he was sentenced to die another time. However, the accounts say that he perished with a fever just before the execution date, conveniently. The story, however, doesn't necessarily end there. Rumors swirl that Duchesne escaped death once more. One version said that there was a coffin buried, but in the coffin was a log, not Duchesne's body, to give the weight to it. I became a part of this story myself when I was the head of the Kentucky Historical Society. It was actually before I was head, though, when I was the editor. I was working there in the research room, and a researcher from Hawaii was there, and she told me another version of the story. She explained to her, Duchesne had escaped to Hawaii from Texas, had married there, had become the physician to the royal family because he knew health issues. He'd had to take care of his own throat that he'd cut and so forth, and became a physician to the royal family. and was on his deathbed, he admitted that he had been Isaac Bledsoe Deshaies, and he was under, because he was under a different name there. And according to her, the Deshaies family refused to recognize this because there were mixed blood in the family as a result of that marriage. And the genealogy doesn't seem to exactly fit, but there's a hint of suspicion for that story. So I've decided that I need to take a tax-deductible trip to Hawaii to find out the real truth behind all of this. But that real truth probably remains another history mystery. So let's talk now to the third attack of this scandal virus, which seems to strike very frequently and very forcefully in Kentucky. It's James W. Honest Dick Tate. How many of you heard of Honest Dick Tate? More of you have heard of that, I bet. Yeah. Well, not too many. Okay. I have a picture here of Honest Dick Tate and James Wilkinson. You can pass those around. 1888. Honest Dick Tate is a state treasurer. He sets out for Louisville. He's been treasurer for 20 years, but elected for 10 two-year terms. Had a lot of friends in government, as he should have, because he's given them advances on their salary, he's given them personal loans. All the key people in government owe him something, in a sense. After time, though, these people begin to worry because their friend, Honest Dick Tate, doesn't show back up in his office after a few days. They begin to check out what's going on. What they find horrifies them. Tate had run an incredibly loose office. There were no checks and balances. And in that position of that lax atmosphere, Honest Dick Tate had invested the state's funds in private real estate and mineral investigations. He'd done so without any authorization. He usually did so without profit, in fact, and with considerable loss to the state and to himself. Another person said, when they were asking about his disappearance, he said, well, I didn't think it was strange that Honest Dick Tate left. But he said, I did question a little bit that I saw him with a roll of bills that were 4 inches thick that he was stuffing in his pocket. And he stuffed 2 tobacco sacks full of silver and gold before he left. Just another day at the office. I don't have those in my office, but Kentucky House quickly impeached, and then the Senate removed Tate from office for high crimes and misdemeanors. The legislature determined finally that Tate had been a little short in his accounts, about $247,000, which was one-tenth of the state's budget. Now, in today's term, that would be like embezzling $800 million if you took a tenth of the state's budget today. 57-year-old Tate had defrauded the state and had disappeared. So what happened to him? Well, he left behind a wife and a married daughter. And they received secret letters for a time from him. And the letters were dated from Canada, from China, from Brazil. So he probably make and then the letters stopped after a couple of years. We don't know what happened to Honest Dick Tate. Did he return to the United States under an assumed name and then use his wealth to live a comfortable life? Did he flash his ill-begotten gains in some South American country and was killed for his money? Or did he just die a forgotten man in a distant land? We don't know. What we do know is that his high crimes and misdemeanors had a very important effect on Kentucky, though, because 2 years after this, Kentucky holds a constitutional convention to draft the constitution we now have. And delegates wanted now to limit state officials to one term of office because he'd served 10 two-year terms, 20 straight years in office. One person said at that convention, he said, the longer he stays in there, the more he steals. So they placed a restriction that you could only serve one term, the governor. Kentucky was one of the last states to do away with that restriction in 1992 with the constitutional amendment at that time. So, as Thomas Clark once wrote, he said, the restless ghosts of Dick Tate lingers on in the corridors of Frankfort to remind Kentuckians of the folly of a permanent love affair with a public servant. So he lives on, in a sense. A decade after that, really less than a decade, another much beloved public servant gains not only state but national attention in Kentucky, and his story involved not finances but sex. Now that I've got your attention, so. William Campbell Preston Breckinridge. How many of you have Willie? So. Willie, as he was known, about half a dozen here. 1893. He's the son of a minister, the loving father of 5, serving in Congress at that time. He'd been in Congress almost a decade. He was a person of seemingly unlimited promise. An individual who seldom smoked, seldom drank, seldom played cards, or even bet on the Kentucky thoroughbreds. But unknown to them, Willie Breckinridge did have one weakness. Her name was Madeline Pollard. She petitioned the court, and I see some historians dribbling in here. You missed James Wilkinson, and you missed Joseph Duchesne, and you missed Honest Dick Tate. So now we're getting to Willie Breckinridge.
I'll answer the rest of the week,
then. You can steal this for the rest of your discussions. Madeline Pollard petitioned the court. She said, I want a judgment of $50,000 for breach of promise because Breckinridge had promised to marry me and did not. According to her, about a decade before, on April the 1st, an appropriate date probably, when she was, in her words, a maiden at the age of 17 and he was a married man of 47, 30 years older, they had met. Quickly, he completed his seduction of her, she said, and had placed her at Sayre School near him in Lexington, so she would be conveniently located. 2 years after that, she went to Washington to be closer to the new congressman. She apparently succeeded because she became pregnant for the second time. After his wife's death, Breckinridge, she said, Madeline Pollard said, had promised marriage, but then he had secretly married instead a cousin. And so, she said, despite the fact that during this whole time, she continued to see him, in her words, once a day, sometimes twice a day, and during the evening. But when he secretly married that cousin, she decided she would seek revenge, because she thought he had said he would marry her instead. And this is front page news across the nation. In fact, there were three books that appeared. One of them is filled with blank spaces. It's a testimony from the trial, and they took out all the references because they thought it would, you know, young people shouldn't read this in the book. So it's even worse when you read the book. You know, and Madeline Pollard said, Breckinridge, blank. You know, and so your imaginations are worse than probably what she did say. Here's one of the cleaner ones that I'll pass around. It's called Madeline Pollard versus Breckinridge Celebrated Breach of Promise Case. I've marked here with a picture of Madeline Pollard for those of you who want to see her. But as the nation watched, as the nation read these stories, Breckinridge took the stand in his own defense. He claimed Pollard had not been unsoiled, as his words, when he met her, and she had lured him as much as he had lured her, which kind of supports the epigram that it takes two people to make one seduction. His attorneys tried to introduce depositions which supported his contentions. From her hometown near Frankfurt, a store owner said he knew the plaintiff to be a lewd girl, and he had caught her, quote, in a compromising position. Another man said he'd found her in a covered bridge in another, quote, compromising position. It sounds like Henry Clay was not the only great compromiser in Kentucky. But in several unfavorable rulings, the judge refused to allow the evidence, calling it too filthy and too obscure. Although when I was in the Library of Congress doing my book on the Breckinridges of Kentucky, this material had been sealed since it'd been deposited there in 1904. This was in the 1970s. And I looked and it said it had been supposed to be sealed for half a century when the time had passed. I said, can I look at this? And so they bring out this big packet of materials with a little bow around it. And said, yes, you can. So I pulled the bow and I started going into this material, seeing all these depositions and things. It certainly beat what I had been doing, which was reading the congressional record. Breckinridge was called the silver-tongued orator of Kentucky because he was such a great speaker. Now he's on the stand, but he admits, he said, passion, the seduction, he said, had occurred. He said, I was a man of passion, she was a woman of passion, we yielded ourselves to each other, but that was all. He admitted that, yes, he had given her large sums of money. Yes, he had told acquaintances and hotel keepers that she was his daughter when she traveled with him. But he said, there's one punishment which I have not deserved, and that is to marry the woman who was concerned with me in this act. The jury, though, supported her plea, and they awarded Pollard $15,000, which was at that time 3 years' salary of a congressman. And then she disappears from history. And so I always, when I talk about this, if any of you know anything about Madeline Pollard, let me know, because what she did, she went on the lecture circuit, and she acted in some plays for about a year when she was well known as a celebrity, and her 15 minutes of fame was there, and then she disappears. I looked in the New York Times for an obituary, thinking that maybe, you know, that would be there, but if she married, of course, her obituary would be under another name. The Lexington papers were under the control of the Breckenridge family, so they didn't say anything about her. And they wanted her to disappear from memory as quickly as possible. So I don't know what happened to her. She was, in 1893, she was only 26 years old. So she was still a young girl at the time. Breckenridge decided to seek re-election after this came out. And an outcry agreed to that declaration. The Christian League for the Promotion of Social Purity demanded his ouster, as did the Women's Rescue League of Boston. A college professor in Lexington called Breckenridge a menace to every virgin, a depraved man of beastly lusts, a wild beast in search of prey. Let the rapist die, he concluded. We think politics are tough now. Remember, women could not vote, but they had a real influence in this election because they ordered their daughters not to date anybody who says they're going to vote for Breckenridge. They also, in essence, boycott stores that have Breckenridge stickers and things like that in their windows. So indirectly, his race energizes women and helps the suffrage movement in the state. Now, during the campaign, he openly faced the issue. He said he talked about it on his campaign trail, but he still had to defend himself. There were stories that were appearing that said that he was very prominent in his Presbyterian church, that he had gone to Sunday school and taught his Sunday school class, and then the interim before church started, he would go over to visit Madeline Pollard, and then after that interlude, he would come back and hear the sermon. So his own band was very defiant about this on his campaign train. His band would end his campaign with the song, "The Girl I Left Behind Me." So election day came. Breckenridge is a very powerful, popular man, and he loses by 1% of the vote. He lives for a decade more. He's editor of the Lexington Herald during that decade and writes great editorials. He did travel some. According to tradition, he was once boarding a ship for a trip to England. A man watched the old reprobate board the ship, and he turned to a friend and said, "God save the Queen." Of course, as we all know, that was the last sex scandal ever in Kentucky history. Politicians at both the state and the national level learned from history, and they never again ventured into such sexual blunders as that, or not. Maybe we need more leaders who do learn from history. And the last scandal on today's menu is a more recent one, in some ways more extensive, in some ways more troubling. And this is one that most of you know about, and that is what became known as BOP Trot. The BOP, for the Business, Operations, and Professions Committee in Frankfurt, and the Trot for the trotting track industry that was involved. It all became public on March the 30th, 1992, when some 30 FBI agents swept through the state capitol, confronting legislators, taking statements, arresting people. It began a political quake that would shake the foundations of state government. And I was in the state government at that time, so I remember that day pretty vividly. I wasn't in the Capitol building. So. But as you know, Kentucky's had a very large history of political corruption. One that goes beyond the examples we've discussed. Political lobbying groups have been out there dominating often legislative sessions. There have been political bosses who've controlled the votes in their counties. Wealth can determine their outcomes. Simple voter manipulation has proved very popular. One observer noted that buying votes is as common here as buying groceries. And at other times, friendly election officials simply didn't want to spend the money, so they saved the money by controlling the vote. In 1903, there was a famous Franklin County precinct. It had 115 registered voters. In that particular election, 219 people voted, all for the same candidate, and all alphabetically. The interesting names that they found on the voter rolls when they started examining all this were such names as A. Apple, P. Plum, P. Pear, and R. Raspberry. Others doing their civic duty included C. Corn, C. Coffee, C. Clover, B. Grass, I guess Bluegrass, as well as F. Fence, R. Road, R. Rock, H. Hog, and probably getting desperate at this time for names, H. Old and A. New. 219 names like that. And of course, sometimes the dead people were on the rolls of the voting. In a couple cases, they were listed that way, as the address was the cemetery. When confronted by that odd fact in nearby Logan County, a well-known boss there admitted that such things did occur. He said, "We know all those dead people. We know they were all good Democrats who would like to keep on voting for their friends if they could have. We would just carry out their wishes. A man's not much of a Democrat if he won't help out a dead Betty. Over the years, a lot of different ways, many people from both parties helped out their dead Bettys. Out of that atmosphere grew Bobtrot in 1990. The specific start came in 1990 when a lame duck state senator from Paducah called a trotting track owner who wanted more inter-track betting for his track. And she said she could solve his problem if he gave $100,000. He talked to the FBI, sent her $2,000, and the investigation began. 2 years later, a major lobbyist reluctantly started to help the FBI after hearing all the evidence that was against him, so he was in a sense kind of turning state's evidence, as we'd later say. He set up a sting operation, and they taped 1,000 different transactions on tape. During the sweep to the Capitol followed soon after that. Before it all ended, 20 people would be convicted or plead guilty. 16 of them legislators or former legislators. Plus one organization, the Jockey Guild, admitted it paid bribes of $1,500 to a senator for him and some other legislators to use to gamble in Vegas. The former state auditor of Kentucky, then a vice president, Humana, admitted paying $10,000 to a former state senator for her crucial vote on a bill to ease state controls on hospital expansion. Meanwhile, the nephew and the appointment secretary of then-Governor Wallace Wilkinson admitted to receiving $20,000 in exchange for influencing the appointment of an arbiter who ruled favorably for a racetrack. The nephew eventually received a 3-year sentence for conspiracy to commit extortion. Legislators from both parties, of both sexes, from all areas of the state, either plea-bargained or were found guilty of felony charges of extortion, mail fraud, racketeering, and lying to federal agents. That was a favorable one. The biggest target was the Speaker of the Kentucky House. His refusal to cooperate earned him the longest sentence, 64 months in prison. He also became the symbol for the entire scandal when he was filmed accepting money from a lobbyist. He put the money in his pocket and then said, "God bless your heart." That's a tear to the eye. Maybe the most surprising fact, though, of this whole thing is how little it took to bribe a legislator. That really shocked me more than anything else. A $100 handshake and a jumbo shrimp dinner would probably do it. One historian, Tom Clark, noted that it's embarrassing that our legislators were bought so cheaply. Somebody on a talk show said at the time, BOP, BOP, should stand for bribe our politicians. Now, the decades since that time, many of the same issues still remain, as you know. Powerful lobbyists, influence of money in races, acceptance of vote fraud, sometimes through vote handling cases and absentee ballots and things like that. So, what do all these tell us about our state and about ourselves? Well, first, we should probably recognize that each of us would form our own answers on how we view things through our political glasses. Now, many historians would probably not classify the politician's sex scandal as a particularly important factor in judging a person's career as in office. They might point out that at least half of the last dozen American presidents, for example, either had or were accused on good evidence of having extramarital affairs. Yet many of them had very successful presidencies. But others may judge a person in a position of power as a symbol, as an example, believing, as one person wrote, "A man of character resists the influence of evil." To them, the betrayal of a private trust may reflect on the public performance. In Willie Breckinridge's case, for instance, he had a strong career of public service, one that ended in the aftermath of his scandal. Maybe we shouldn't be surprised by these examples of failed morality. After all, Kentucky-born Speaker of the House said early in the 20th century, he said, "An election to Congress does not in any way or to any degree reduce the human quality in men. They bring with them their passions, prejudices, tempers, likes, dislikes, and their ideas as to behavior. We should expect perfection, but understand that we are all imperfect." But if there remains a debate about those private acts and how much they should be an influence, there should be no debate about these things of public responsibility. National security, the Wilkinson case. Control of the public purse, the Tate case. The sanctity of the vote, Bobtrot. The integrity of the courts and the pardon, DeShay. Perhaps really all these reveal appropriately the quote that power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. many of the scandals took place when there wasn't a good check system of checks and balances. The Tate affair reflected that, as did Shea, for instance. So to conclude, part of this fault in these scandals falls on the society in which they occur. Yet we all stand condemned when we avert our eyes from fraud, or when we say that everybody is doing that. We should demand better of our representatives, of our society, and of ourselves. Thanks. I do have a box trap scoreboard if anybody wants to see who was convicted there. There's all 20 of them there. So.
We have time for some questions, and then we'll do a door prize.
I should note on the questions that I was giving a talk in Logan County with my wife about our fourth grade text, maybe 6 months or so ago, to a middle school group there. Well, a group that went all the way from elementary to middle school. And at the end of the half day, we all went to the gym. So this whole school was there. And they opened up for questions for me. And some of the questions were really good. But some of the questions were very unusual questions. You know, one of them said, how many caves are there in Kentucky? Another said, another question, I've been talking about how we should study history and it's all about the future and things like that. And one little, probably elementary first grader, she tentatively raised her hand and she said, what is the future? To her, there was no idea of what a future meant, you know. And probably the best one was that, to me, I'd been talking about buffalo, and somebody said, how come they didn't domesticate buffalo? I attempted to answer that. Somebody followed that up there with a question and said, how big was a buffalo's stomach? So whatever questions you ask, I'm going to pale in comparison to those questions. So I'll be glad to answer anything on Kentucky history. I can say I don't know to anything. So. Whatever you've always wanted to know.
Haven't said anything about the most recent two scandals in the gubernatorial, and how did those fit into the pantheon of Kentucky scandals?
Depends on how you want to define them. I think the pardon one, that's, as Nancy Baird can tell you, that's been an issue since the person she wrote about, Governor Blackburn, lenient Luke, when he was called for his pardons that he issued at that time. So the issue of pardons has always been an issue. The merit system issue has always, that's popped up several times over the years. Since it's, you know, the reason it was put in is because you used to go around, and if you worked for the state, you were appointed to that position. And every year you had to go around and pay about 3% of your salary to the governor that had appointed you. And they were slush funds that would help come out of that were used to re-elect different governors. In fact, one of the times, Happy Chandler had sent his to an offshore bank, and happened to be in Cuba, for safekeeping so that nobody could track it very easily. And it turned out that it was in Cuba when Castro took over and nationalized it. And so there was this cartoon of Happy Chandler, you know, standing on that Key West looking out over the ocean saying, you know, Castro, send back my money. So that, you know, the issue, and that's why the merit system was put in place, to keep people that from happening. But ever since it's been put in place, there have been attempts to try to get around the merit system. Louis Mann tried to do that. There was a court case against him by Pritchard that won, and he had to go against that. John Rob Brown tried to get around the merit system. What he tried to do was basically he would abolish the position, so the person, and then he would reinstate it under a different name and then hire his own person for that. That was also declared illegal. So the merit system periodically pops up, the pardon system periodically pops up. Paul Patton, I see that was the other one you were talking about. Although there have been a lot of other examples in this case, too. There was in 2000, there was a woman from education who pleaded guilty to embezzling $500,000 from the state.
We don't know where she was from.
Yes. And then there was the LRC scandal, which is another one that involved various things. So, you know, these the different things. But the patent one, a little trickier because before Watergate, you know, the politicians weren't subjected to the scrutiny that we have now. You know, John F. Kennedy had numerous affairs. Well, you know, nobody said anything about any of them, but they were pretty well known at the time. And there was said half a dozen of the last dozen presidents have had affairs at some time in their career. So it's all been recently that we started putting the scrutiny on politicians' sexual life. Whereas in those earlier days, there were probably a lot of other governors who did those kind of things. They probably did it through houses of prostitutions like Paul Eames, and places who talk, she talks about prominent politicians, but not to mention them by name there. So there probably was that, but we just don't know much about it as we do there. So other things, probably was, of course, the assassination of the governor. There was a truck scandal in the 60s where somebody was buying used trucks with new truck money. An insurance scandal under Jerry and Carol time where several of his people were convicted. Textbook scandal under Douglas Sampson, who accepted money from the textbook companies to get their textbooks in. So there's all kinds of different ones out there. What are the questions on Kentucky history, though, that you always wanted to ask? Yes?
Remark about who you think were a couple Kentucky statesmen who had real courage instead of the scandals.
Okay.
Really had political courage.
Let's have a whole other talk on this one.
I'll just stick around another half an hour.
I'll give you I'll give you one example quickly from Albert Barkley from Paducah. He was majority leader of the United States Senate, vice president called Aviv. Majority leader, very powerful time under the New Deal and under World War II. And at the end of World War II, they had passed the Congress, Senate had passed a tax bill. They had taken a hard time to get the tax bill through. It took a lot of compromise, a lot of arm pulling, everything else. The bill finally goes through, and it goes to FDR, and he vetoes it, saying it's a bill not for the needy, but for the greedy. Probably the veto message actually was written by another Kentuckian named Pritchard, actually. And it goes back to Alvin Barkley. Barkley feels like the Senate's honor has been attacked because they've done everything they could, and he, by using those words, it's kind of a harsh indictment of the bill. And so he resigns in protest. The next day, he's unanimously re-elected as Senate Majority Leader. But what makes that an act of courage, I would say, in a sense, politically, is at the time, he was under consideration, and serious consideration, as a potential vice president candidate, because FDR was dumping his vice president, Wallace, and was going to pick another person in 1944, same year this was taking place. And had Barkley not done that, he might well have been the choice of FDR. But he alienates FDR by his actions. And FDR picks Harry Truman, who becomes president shortly after that. And so, you know, Barkley becomes vice president under Truman instead of under FDR. But you know, that's the kind of examples, I think, and the kind of acts that require courage. Another person I'll talk about in that is Madeline McDowell Breckinridge, Madge Breckinridge, who I consider maybe the most important woman in Kentucky's history in a lot of ways. And I see her an act of courage in a different way. She, picture is 18 years old, she's living in Lexington. She's, you know, she's the great-granddaughter of Henry Clay, comes in a high family. She goes to balls, she dances, she rides horses, you know, she does all the things a young active girl would do at that time. And then she discovers at the age of 18 she has tuberculosis of the bone. And at the age of 22, her leg has, one part of her leg has to be amputated. Now that Victorian society, that kind of something happening to you, most women would retreat from society. You know, stay in the home behind heavy curtains and drapes and recommend visitors to her, but not do anything beyond that. She instead goes out and becomes a leader of the women's rights movement in Kentucky and one of the leaders of the nation, a vice president of the national organization. And she keeps her sense of humor. You know, one of her famous quotes, she's going to a governor and asking for his support, and she says, "Listen, Governor, Kentucky women are not idiots, even though they are closely related to Kentucky men." So she keeps that, despite all this. She has a heart attack when she's in her 30s. Her husband is a son of Willie Breckinridge, actually. And he's very important in her career because he's the editor of the Lexington paper, which gets her a forum for her cause. But he has an affair with her best friend. So despite all of this, she keeps on fighting and gets Kentucky to be one of the states that ratifies the Women's Suffrage Amendment, one of the only four southern states that does so in 1920. She votes one time. And she dies, I think, at the age of 42, right after she votes, I mean, the same month. So that was her tragedy, was she only voted once. Her success was that she did vote. So those are the kinds of examples, I think, that show the other side of Kentucky politics, that people we overcome problems, we overcome and take stands that are unpopular because they believe in the stands, and we work for what they see as the better good of the state and the country. More than you are to hear.
Other questions? In summing up, how would you rank Kentucky in the kind of pantheon of states in terms of corruption? Were we more corrupt, less corrupt?
It's hard because I haven't studied other states as thoroughly as I have Kentucky. The general histories, and you know, I've looked at my field of Southern history, so I've read more Southern history than anything else. The state that rivals Kentucky in the South is
Louisiana.
Yeah, I think Louisiana has a good history of that. Huey Long there, and they've had a storied history that way. You know, we're not as different from the South as we might think we are sometimes on some of these things, because I think all Southern states have these kind of stories throughout them. But they may not have been, some of the time, you know, when the South was a one-party state, you know, it wasn't quite as important for the fights there as it was in Kentucky. Well, Kentucky, for a lot of its time, was a two-party state. Even though the Democrats dominated, it still had a strong Republican Party by the time. So, you know, that may have made the fights a little different in Kentucky than it did in some of the Southern states. But the South pretty much has a good tradition of that, too. I have another talk on this Kentucky Seven. So.
Well, with that, we're going to move to the door prize. And